Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. As an executive editor at Marvel Comics, Axel Alonso supervises mainstream books like The Amazing Spider-Man and quirkier titles like Squadron Supreme, the Max Punisher book, and Black Panther. He's also supervised controversial runs like The Truth, the retcon story of a black Captain America, the gay depiction of the Rawhide Kid, and the ultra-violent Nick Fury miniseries. Axel came to Marvel from DC's Vertigo imprint, where he oversaw projects like Preacher and 100 Bullets. Today we talk about many of Alonso's past, present, and future titles, along with his input on the Marvel event Civil War. Our conversation begins with a look at Axel's early comic book tastes.
Don't get me wrong, as a kid, I had Spider-Man comics and Hulk comics and Batman comics. Like, I remember geeking out over the Neil Adams Batmans, which I picked up in back issue bins. I'm not that old, but but I always kind of gravitated toward some of the, I guess you call them the B-tier characters. You know, at DC, I was a big fan of the war books. You name it, if they were in combat, I liked them. At Marvel, I liked, you know, Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu, Luke Cage, Hero for Hire. For some reason, I always loved the Inhumans. I liked Triton. I always aspired to be able to breathe underwater, and he was able to do that, so kind of liked him.
You had a journalism background before getting into comics?
Yeah.
What did you do?
A little bit of everything. I worked in magazines and newspapers. I did reporting, law reporting,
okay,
political reporting. I was part of a startup venture, internet political gossip rag. I wrote on arbitration and mediation, which is as boring as it sounds. I worked for the Berkeley Monthly, which is kind of like the Village Voice of the San Francisco Bay Area.
Gotcha.
As an editor there. I generally found that I got paid a lot of money for boring stuff and got paid very little for fun stuff. So I tried to find a way to merge the good money with the fun stuff.
Was this mostly on the West Coast?
No, it was back and forth. Actually, probably mostly out here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were there other magazines or newspapers we'd be aware of, or even the internet?
Yeah. No, I wrote features for Daily News, The Post, the Daily News Magazine, variety of hip-hop magazines and stuff like that. I wrote a lot about sort of street culture and stuff like that. I got my job, actually, because I was interviewed about an article I'd written, the use of the cannabis leaf in hip-hop. And the editor at Vertigo had called me in because he remembered my name, which is uncommon, and he remembered I'd written an article about the way that the cannabis leaf is used in hip-hop, and interviewed a DEA agent in charge of marijuana enforcement laws on one side and then the editor of High Times on the other. And this guy didn't like, he had his girlfriend stolen by the editor at High Times, so he liked the article. So,
which editor was, or do you not want to say?
The editor who interviewed me is the late Lou Stathis.
Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah, I was hired by him.
Okay.
More than a decade ago.
Wow. And at Vertigo, you edited things like 100 Bullets and Preacher.
Yeah.
So that's cool. And again, kind of Odd Duck books. Vertigo in general, you know, obviously the riskier arm of DC in terms of edgy content and clearly an adult audience.
Well, Vertigo was definitely a good entry point for me into comics because it would have been like going, you know, cold turkey heroin to go from the real world to superhero.
Okay.
It was a good sort of transition for me to get into comics because it dealt with mature themes.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I knew working at Vertigo that I have nothing but respect for Neil Gaiman and what he's doing, or what he did on Sandman, for instance. But I also knew that I had nothing to contribute as an editor to a book like that, that his references are not a part of my background. So I always knew that I wasn't going to be doing books that dealt with, fantastic magical pantheons shorthand I use as the unicorn books. I wasn't a unicorn book. I was a gun-in-the-mouth book type of editor. So I kind of gravitated toward that. Now, when I say that it was a good transition for me, I don't mean that I grew past Vertigo, because I really do feel that comics are a medium, not a genre. You know, the fact that I do mostly superheroes now doesn't mean that I don't like the other stuff. You follow me?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, my favorite monthly comic book is The Walking Dead by Robert Kirkman.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Wow, ballsy, man. There you go. Another company, too.
Exactly. Hey, fuck it. All they can do is fire me. But also, Robert knows I like it because he's got a leg up because I'm generally of the feeling, excuse me, I'm generally of the opinion that anything is improved by the appearance of a zombie.
So. See, no, and I think, and I mean, Walking Dead is a great book, but I do think that there are so many other zombie books out there right now. No offense to Marvel Zombies, which was a very fun project,
yeah.
And Kirkman did a great job with it as well. But I'm kind of getting zombied out. There's like a little too many zombies out there.
Well, there's where you and I will have to part ways.
There never can be enough zombies.
No, no, no. Just give me a zombie, and I'm there. I'll plop down my money.
Before we get into the specific books that you directly oversee, as executive editor, how would you describe your job compared to DiDio at DC, who also shares the title in name, but it sounds like, you know, he and Joe are more contemporaries in terms of the way they do things. Or
yeah.
You tell me what you do.
Yeah. Well, certainly Dan DiDio at DC is what Joe does here,
mm-hmm.
insofar as that I think he's involved with the overall universe of DC and certainly is the public face of DC, whereas Joe is obviously the public face of Marvel. You know, my job is I'm involved in a lot of story mapping, of course, and I'm involved in decisions about writers and where they're going to go and artists and where they go. So it's kind of hard to describe my position. I fill in a lot of cracks.
Okay.
Obviously, there's a large emphasis on story for me and being involved in the discussions about the direction a book might take, like The Hulk, for instance, which I don't directly edit. But, you know, it's arguable that the other senior editors or the recently made executive editor, Tom, also play comparable roles.
Okay.
Just I look more handsome doing it.
Now, Tom is overseeing Civil War. You have a leg in, or an involvement in Civil War, a leg. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You have an involvement in Civil War, obviously, through Spider-Man and through some of the books that will tie into it. Were you in those meetings in terms of the Civil War planning?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, basically, the Civil War stuff is stuff that we brainstormed as a core group of editors, later whittled down to the senior editors and some of our top writers.
Okay.
Tom is the Marvel Universe proper editor, you know.
I see.
Tom has forgotten more about the Marvel U than I could ever learn in that regard. So, you know, he's the obvious person, this being a new Avengers-type event, the obvious person to be spearheaded that is Tom. He's done a fantastic job.
Can you tell us some of the other people, or would we... Is it pretty obvious as far as who else was in that meeting? I know that, you know,
well,
reporting that's going on, we have Bendis, Millar, Straczynski.
Yeah, it's no secret that we have every quarter or so we have an editorial summit where some of our top writers, guys like Straczynski and Bendis and Mark Miller, come in and sit down and brainstorm with us. And it's actually more just like a big conversation than a stodgy meeting.
Sure.
We toss around ideas. Jeff Loeb, of course, was at the most recent last couple as well. And we just toss around ideas. We argue. We wander down weird sort of story paths and see where they take us. It's a good, healthy environment because there's no lack of arguing and finger pointing. It's all in good fun at the end of the day. And we just see where that takes us. You know, in the case of Civil War, it certainly was Mark's idea more than anyone else's in the room, and we talked it through and came up with Civil War. But make no mistake, Mark's the writer.
Sure. Is the fact that Civil War is starting at the end of Infinite Crisis, I would imagine that to some degree you guys were looking across the street, seeing what they were doing, and the reader response to the way the story was laid out, not only in Infinite Crisis, but in the tie-in issues, because I noticed that Joe says in the back of Civil War number one, we're taking an effort to make this a very approachable series for any newcomer to jump in and appreciate.
Yeah. Well, let me start by just coming clean and saying that I'm probably, of all the editors here, I'm the most suspicious of crossovers, and everybody knows that. I'm like the hippie in the military family.
Cool.
You know? The thing for me is that I really need to be sold on it. I understand the need for crossovers, and I think they can be a lot of fun. I mean, you know, not to date myself, but I loved the Avengers Defenders War as a kid.
Sure.
You know, I remember trying to dig up those old issues just to see the Vision fight the Silver Surfer or Hulk fight Thor. That was really supremely cool stuff as a kid. So it's not like I'm an idiot and don't understand the necessity of having these events. That said, I like to try and, my POV is that I like to make sure that they're as accessible as possible and that they don't uproot what's going on in the other books. You know, for me, I guess it's a product of when I grew up reading comics, but when I was reading comics in the 20 to 25 cent era, there wasn't that much interconnectedness. Spider-Man would pop up in the Hulk or vice versa, but there wasn't this attempt to link all of them and the Fantastic Four and the Avengers against some common foe. And then, you follow what I'm saying here?
Yes.
You know, so for me, I think that I always viewed these comics as, I knew they were part of a shared universe, but I like to enjoy them as their own little microcosms. So I still feel that way as an editor, but I also have made great pains to make sure that people understand that the books that I'm working on are part of that larger tapestry. You walk a line here,
mm-hmm.
you know, with what I like about Civil War is really simple, is that I feel that we're using the vocabulary of superhero and superhero theatrics to comment on stuff that matters right now. You know, the core issue of Civil War is something that most Americans are thinking about right now, which is how much of your freedom are you willing to give up for more safety?
Yep.
And whose freedom are you willing to give up is another one of those questions. So I think that what I support about Civil War, as perhaps the person who needed the most sort of prodding, is what I support about this project is the fact that I feel that we're saying something about stuff that matters right now. When I was a kid, the comics I read said stuff about stuff that I saw on the street. And I like that. So I like the fact that our event isn't about old comics. I like the fact that it's about the real world. Now, how accessible it is remains to be seen. I think it's all relative. I do, having read Civil War I 3 or 4 times at this point, I think it's pretty accessible.
I would agree.
You know, at the end of the day, what's not to understand about a man dressed in red, white, and blue being asked by a government operative to round up vigilantes? I think people will get the idea. I think my wife would understand what Cap represents.
Yes.
So, you know, I guess hopefully I've answered your question.
You have, and I appreciate your skepticism, and I think readers will as well. You're right. I think events sometimes, for all, you know, the good plans intended, sometimes they just don't work, and it really needs a reason to exist, and I think that you've explained the reason of why Civil War is being told.
But also in terms of the offshoots, I think that what is useful is to mention is that the tie-ins that we're doing are ones where the writers and books are opting in. Straczynski embraces making Amazing Spider-Man the tie-in book
okay.
to Civil War. And had he not embraced that, then either Peter David or Roberto Sacasa in either of their books would have been the tie-in book. So if you read Straczynski's, that's the place to get the official Civil War tie-in. Peter's book, Friendly Neighborhood, and Roberto's book, Sensational, they're not going to contradict anything you see in Civil War, but you can continue reading those books in the microcosm of the Spider-Man universe. So let's just say for a minute that you don't give a damn about Civil War, then fine, don't buy Amazing Spider-Man.
Sure.
Buy the other two. That's how I feel. You know, again, I feel that what our responsibility is to do is to just try and make sure that you don't have to buy 70 books to understand the one or two characters you like.
That's cool, and it seems like Civil War is pretty much covering you if you only want to read Civil War. Based on the first issue,
exactly.
You are getting the story. The one thing I will say, and I like it, and I have been reading Amazing Spider-Man, was the dynamic between Tony Stark and Peter Parker, and the friendship that's developed, and now the wrinkle of the seeds that you guys planted in Amazing that I'm sure will come through in Civil War when you see what Iron Man is doing in the background.
Exactly.
Unbeknownst to Peter.
Yeah, there's nuances. There's depth to story in that relationship that can only be found in Amazing Spider-Man. You know, I know that when the Punisher shows up in Civil War, that's going to be an oh shit moment. I'm not giving away any spoilers to say that that was the perfect place for us to launch the Marvel U Punisher book that I'd been dreaming of doing, because it's the perfect time. His profile will be so high come that moment in Civil War that people will be wanting to see Punisher. The Punisher in the black suit with the white gloves and the white boots. Not shooting Gambinos, but shooting supervillains. And finding a bigger gun. You know, here comes Galactus. Time to get a bigger gun. You know? So, you know, again, that's another instance where we can tie in. But, you know, we've recently had our Moonlight launch, for instance.
Yes.
And that book has been a phenomenon. We sold 125,000 copies of book one. So kudos to the creators. But the long and short is that it's like, look, that book, the first arc is just about Moonlight and establishing him. The second arc, for which we've got the first couple of scripts, now it's about integrating him into the Marvel Universe and sort of positioning him relative to the other heroes and explaining where he fits.
Charlie will continue to write that second arc then?
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool. I liked the first issue. I felt it was, to be honest, the only thing I would say, and I usually don't critique a book when in the midst of an interview, but I thought it was a little too much setup and not enough story in that first chapter. But I know that Charlie's a good writer. I'm a big fan of his books.
What I would say respectfully, and not to argue with you, is that
not at all.
I never understand the comment that it was too much setup simply because I liked the first third of Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it as much as the second or third part of Godfather, if you follow me.
I do.
So for me, I think as long as that read entertains and moves forward, the point of Moon Knight 1 was to do was establish for you that you're watching a guy in full glory doing what he does best, and it's like an LP playing, and it's moving along beautifully, and then it just starts to skip, and you realize that everything you've seen happened, but it happened some time ago, and our guy slipped. You follow me?
I do.
For me, it's about the immersion of the experience, and I know that there's a lot of talk these days about decompressed stories and so on, and the people who are most vocal, of course, the people who want the stories decompressed. You follow what I'm saying here.
I do.
And again, there's a lot of friction there, but I think responsibility of the writer, artist, and editor is to make sure that it was just, that it was, you want to come back for more.
Yeah, well, and I guess that was the problem. Now, using your Godfather analogy, obviously they got the whole story in one sitting. A lot of the decompressed stories that people knock on, if you read the trade or if you wait and read all the issues together, more times than not, they're excellent stories. And I have this conversation with Bendis all the time where I love them when I've got all six chapters. There are times when a first chapter or a middle chapter, however, standing on its own, is not as satisfying. Yeah. And I guess
Bendis takes it more than anyone I know of,
you're right.
In terms of the public court of public opinion. He's also, you know, arguably the most popular writer in comics right now.
You're absolutely
right. But it's intriguing because the thing is like, one, there are constraints that we work within in this medium. You know, and I've worked with a number of writers and screenplay writers transitioning them to comics.
Yes.
They always underestimate the skill set that goes into writing a comic script because you don't control time in a comic script the way you do in a screenplay. In a screenplay, you want those extra few beats, take them. In a comic book, you could decide if those extra few beats amount to another page that you need for the next piece of action or for the next scene. And so this is where it all gets tricky, is that the medium itself, you are working within certain constraints.
Sure, it's a big challenge. Good, that leads me to my question, unless you wanted to build on that. In your role as an editor, as you say, you have a lot of writers that are coming from different mediums and novels, films, guys like Charlie Houston and Reggie Hudlin. Would you say that obviously it is transitioning to the medium of comics that is the toughest part of your job in terms of dealing with the writers?
Well, I enjoy working with new writers. It's one of my favorite things to do is work with a new writer and have them bring their voice to the comic book page. So I find it can be one of the more difficult aspects of my job, but it's also one of the more satisfying things. Ditto for artists as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, watching an artist like C.P. Smith, who just did this Wolverine issue for me, just grow in front of my eyes is exciting to me. You know, I love that. But it is hard work. You know, a large part of it is being able to explain to a writer, like a novelist I'm working with right now, about he's written a fantastic script, only the problem is it's too much material for a first issue.
Okay.
And we have what it means to make the hard cuts. I know you want this splash, and you're really attached to this splash page, but we don't have room for it. I can give you 24 pages max at this point, and that's going two above.
Sure.
But we have to finesse the scene and streamline the scene. this is where it's tricky, because if you're writing a screenplay or a book, you've got enough room.
Sure. There's no limit to what any chapter needs to be.
Exactly. So hopefully I've answered your question.
You have. Well, and in the case of specifically Reggie Hudlin, I would say that he, for me, seemed to suffer some growing pains in that first Black Panther arc. I came back to the book, though, when I saw Shang-Chi on the cover and grabbed a couple back issues and got caught up. And I'm really happy with what he's doing on Black Panther. I think it's a lot of fun. And it seems to me that he is a different writer than he was in that first arc.
Yeah, no, I've heard that from a few people. And I'm one of the rare people who likes his first arc better than anything else.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the simplicity of the first arc is what I like. And we've heard it from the same five people under seven different names about the continuity complaints. You know, well, that's not my claw. And
whatever.
You know, what have you. but at the end of the day, I like the immediacy of the first arc. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the stuff with Cage, and that's been beautiful to watch. And we've gotten a lot of mail. So maybe the problem with me is that I really like the launch.
Okay.
But I always get attached to my first arcs. I really do.
Well, you know, I'm enjoying.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, absolutely.
And that's great.
The dynamic between Cage and the Panther was great. And then just following them down to Louisiana, again, tying into real events, I thought was brilliant and really a neat surprise.
Well, I think that's what a lot of people are. Liked and responded to with the second arc and this third arc we're in right now is the dynamic he has with other Marvel Universe characters. I know what with the wedding coming up in July, and especially with the way that the wedding ties in with Civil War, it's an essential reading. And what we have planned after the wedding is going to raise a lot of eyebrows, and I think it's going to further kind of stoke that fan base for the book. You know, it's difficult for a book like Black Panther to find its feeding, especially in a competitive market like this.
Absolutely, and with all these events going on as
well. Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, every time a retailer makes their orders, they have to make hard decisions about how to spend their money. And you know, Black Panther is a character who, he's got a loyal fan base, but it's small and opinionated.
Sure.
thankfully, a lot of the people that keep complaining there, you know, they're still buying, evidently, so...
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I look forward to the marriage, but more importantly, I look forward to the bachelor party, just because I think Marvel has established a good tradition of very interesting bachelor party stories. I remember in The Hulk when Rick Jones had his party and the Stag film came out and there was the bride.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I'm expecting that kind of surprise or interesting novelty to the Panther
bachelor
party.
You have to pick up your lap dance variant cover at the store near you.
Hey, now that brings up an interesting subject, the Max books. You're overseeing The Punisher, and did you do any of the other Max books? I know Shanna began as a Max book. Or...
Yeah. Shanna began as a Max book, but we all agreed that a Marvel Knights imprint would serve us better. So we went that route.
I know you did Supreme Power, too.
Yeah.
And that, of course, became Squadron Supreme.
Yeah. What I will say is that Max is very much alive, and people can look forward to seeing more Max books in the near future as part of our publishing initiative. I can't talk with any specificity about what we're doing.
Okay.
But all three characters that we're revamping under the Max label with three writers of note will be very recognizable to the fans. And I'm real excited about what we're going to be doing with those characters.
And it's easy to just classify Max as tits and ass and you know, being able to say shit and fuck. But obviously, I think there is a good level of adult writing that's going on in there. I love, you know, Garth's Punisher, and it only got better when it became a Max. I'm curious about the War Journal book, and it sounds like you're excited about it.
Yeah.
So
meant to scratch a very different itch than what Garth does. The Garth Punisher is for adults. The Punisher in that book... You know, if you want to believe there's a Spider-Man in the background, fine. But Garth sure as hell doesn't. and the Punisher War Journal is a place to scratch that itch.
Sure.
Where he'll have coffee with Spider-Man or shoot at him, depending upon his mood. But, you know, the Max books, you know, there are a lot of people in comics who are simply against the notion of doing adult material in comics. And it's interesting to me because I even have a good friend, an editor, who says that he doesn't believe there should be mature readers comics. And I never understand that, because the thing is, it's like saying there shouldn't be R-rated movies.
Exactly. It's a medium, as you said before.
Yeah. And it's for me, the Max imprint is a way of not only reaching out to readers who aren't entranced by superheroes, but want genre stuff, be it crime or horror or science fiction. And it's also a way of embracing writers who you would never want to have write Spider-Man. I'll tell you, I can't name names, but the guy who's writing one of these Max books for me was sent my way by Brad Meltzer. And he and I spoke, and he's a huge Punisher fan. And I said, hey, that's great, only bad news. I have no room for you. And we discussed some other options based on the type of writing he does. And he stands to inherit Punisher if ever wants it, and Garth gets sick of it. You follow me?
I do.
But I think that this guy, we found the right character for him, and he's really tearing it up with these scripts. Now, let me say, with all due respect to this guy, I'm never going to hire him for Spider-Man. He's just not that guy. He's
okay.
Not that writer. He knows that. So if I'm making sense here, is that it's like, look, we're a medium. We're not a genre. Comics are, you know, science fiction, Western, crime, romance, superheroes. Just so happens that the top-selling stuff by far is superheroes.
It seems like it with a lot of the books that you oversee, there's not necessarily a new interpretation of an old character, but a new perspective on how the story gets told. And I would point to Bruce Jones' run on the Hulk, which I loved.
Yeah.
And to me, reminded me of the black and white magazine in the 70s that had a bit more of an adult tone.
Sure. Yeah.
And even went further, I think,
yeah.
With Bruce. And I can understand why people who were fans of Hulk Smash didn't like it, but I was ready for a different,
yeah.
You know, voice telling Hulk stories,
went really well on Hulk during that run. It was a steady rising book, well in advance of the movie. It was a gamble that, you know, we took at the time, but it was a decision that I made based on the fact that I felt that Hulk needed a kick in the butt.
Sure.
And that we'd had many, many months of maybe good stories, but they all of good stories, but that there was a certain vibe that the book had, and I felt that the Hulk had lost his sense of scale. That at the time, he was fighting monsters bigger than him all the time. So how big was he? So that was part of the decision, you know, to go the route we did and to go with Bruce. But it's a decision I wouldn't make right now. The zeitgeist of the moment is very different right now. I think that exactly what people want is Planet Hulk, and I was one of the people involved in planning out the prelude and Planet Hulk.
That's cool.
You know, but now, you know, you understand what I'm saying. There's
Absolutely.
There's moments in time, and you have to take it. You have to lick your finger, put it up to the air, get a sense of the way the wind is blowing, and sometimes even decide that you're going to go against the wind and see what happens. But you at least need to see what's out there and make your play.
How about Wolverine? You've got the two monthlies going on now. One adhering to Civil War in
yeah.
the regular Wolverine title, and now Dan is continuing to tell his story in Origins.
Yeah,
and kind of in the same vein as Bruce's Hulk, there seems to be this real attempt to convey a mystery vibe, and you know, one man on a mission, and something very different than what we were seeing as far as a story direction for
yeah.
Wolverine.
Well, there's a lot of Wolverine fans. And I'm not being a company man when I say that I've always felt that the market could support two Wolverine books. The thing is that for those who want Wolverine in the yellow costume, teaming up with Spider-Man and getting involved in Civil War or the next big event, Wolverine will be that tie-in book. Wolverine Origins will have cameos galore. Don't get me wrong, that first arc is going to knock people's socks off with the cameos we have. But the point of that book is to tell the more personal story of Logan and what got him to where he is right now. So my goal as editor is to make sure that both books are worth buying, that both books are essential. Ideally, that Wolverine fans will feel compelled to buy both. But at the end of the day, I just need them to buy one. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
With Wolverine Origins, as you've interviewed Daniel, I mean, again, you know, Daniel spent probably 16 months auditioning for this gig, doing his research on Logan and hammering out his overarching theory of Logan's development. You know, with Origins, he'll be telling pieces of the puzzle that fit between the end of Origin 1 and where we are now, and making sense of a lot of these detours that Logan has made throughout his life, be it, you know, to Japan or Europe during World War II or Madripoor. And obviously he has a way he's attacking right now some of the stuff behind the curtain that went on with Weapon X. He's really digging away at that right now. So I think that for people who like that mystery, ever unfurling mystery, that'll be the book for them.
Would you say, as an editor, that you kind of put yourself in the position of a reader when you're looking over what the script is and what the art is, and is that the voice that you're giving to your creators? Is there that perspective?
Yeah. Well, maybe not exactly that. What I do try and imagine is an audience.
Okay.
And I'll make it clear that I would not buy all the books I edit, personally.
Okay.
but what I do, there are books I edit that I would buy, and there are books that I wouldn't. It doesn't mean that they're bad, even though maybe an individual issue here or there isn't that good. But, you know, they're just not my thing.
Okay.
But that's irrelevant. An editor shouldn't only be editing stuff that is completely and totally up their alley.
Okay.
You have to experiment. You need sometimes an editor is in a position where they're entrusted with a character who, quite frankly, they never liked. That happens all the time. What your responsibility to do is to make sure that you can envision in your mind an audience and why people would like this character in the first place. When Jemis and Joe, when Jemis, way back when, came to me and wanted me to edit at Marvel, he said Spider-Man. I'm like, you're crazy. I haven't read Spider-Man in 15 years. And he, next day I know, I've got all these volumes of Spider-Man on my desk. Brush up, young man. And I did. And I got to know why people like Spider-Man.
Okay.
You follow me? Or
yes.
I recaptured why I like Spider-Man.
Do you develop a book package, or does it start with Joe and hey, we need an X kind of book, and I don't mean a mutant kind of book, but and then you go out and find things? I mean, I understand
it's
that
organic.
Writers come to you.
It's organic. It's
okay.
It's organic. You know,
are there
sometimes
books you can...
it's a top-down initiative where they say we want this. Sometimes it's a creator coming to me.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's me.
Can you name some books that you have developed yourself? And
well, let's see. Wolverine Origins.
Okay.
Black Panther. Storm.
Cool.
Moon Knight.
Oh, really? You were behind the initiative to get the Moon Knight back?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, no, I mean, it was everybody wanted Moon Knight, but everybody wanted Moon Knight for a long time. I mean,
right.
There are a lot of names bandied around, and then I saw Charlie Houston. Charlie Houston's book, Caught Stealing, was on my desk because Rowan Jabateleke sent it my way. I read it, and he said, this guy's interested in comics. And I called him up and talked about Moon Knight with him, and he wanted to do it.
That's
so
cool.
No, it's very organic. There's no one way.
Okay.
You know, most of the projects that I do, I initiate. With a book like the Bruce Jones thing was definitely mine way back when. I think Bill thought I was crazy at the time. You know, the books like Amazing Spider-Man, that tends to be more of a... I mean, that's a flagship book. It's one of the longest running. I mean, I'm not cavalier about that book. There's high-level involvement and decisions made about that. I assure you, the decision to go with a suit wasn't something I made, you know, alone. It
okay.
was something that a lot of people made, and we understood what we were doing when we did it.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, you want people pissed off, I think, a little bit, or at least asking the question, what the hell's going on? And I'm sure sales haven't been hurt
well,
since the
KJ doesn't hurt anyone. I mean, one of the worst things that can happen is if you have a book out there and you make an announcement, and you get very few postings and they're all positive, then you're going to get canceled. really, I sound like I'm being flipped, but I'm not going to name a name, but I remember few years back when I was Top Down Initiative, I had to launch a book, and went out and we made the announcement and everybody came online and there were like 7 or 8 posts and that was it, and they, or 12 posts, you get the gist. They loved it. Sounds like a real hit. And I said, turned to my assistant and said, we're dead. We're dead. You know.
And it turned out to be true, or?
Oh, yeah, it sure as hell did. the best thing that can happen is that you have a variety of different opinions, that there's people that are really angry, there's people who really love it, and that there's a lot of posts. More important, I've had my assistants even dig through, is that they're posts by different people. Now, there's a lot of people that post under different names. We know this because we've done our own research where we track the, let's just say we do our research. But the long and short of it is that there's a lot of people that post under different names.
Okay.
So they'll dominate a debate out there. You follow me? But they're the same guy under 5 names.
Oh, yeah.
So we've caught more than a few people doing that on them.
Wow.
It's funny. But anyway, the long and short of it is that if you've got a lot of different posters and there's a lot of interest, and you end up with 7 or 8 pages on Newsarama, it usually means that you're going to debut pretty well.
Now, that's very interesting because I've been to many conventions and heard many interviews from guys like Joe that have said, you know, the Internet, that's maybe 10% of the actual reading audience. But it sounds like, based on, you know, you obviously do listen to that, or at least are aware of that 10%.
I misrepresented myself then. I want to be clear about one thing. I actually pay very little attention to the Internet. What I said is more a defensive stance, because the thing is that people pay a lot of attention to the Internet and they're influenced by the Internet. For the record, I'm not. I never make a decision based on Internet feedback.
I understand.
Ever.
I understand.
Yeah.
I appreciate the distinction. Absolutely.
And the thing for me is it's more about having been in the business for a while, when we begin to get feedback.
Right.
And buzz going
is
reading that feedback and getting the riding the wave of that feedback and seeing what it means.
Let's talk about a book that pissed off a few people, and that's The Truth, Captain America book. I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was really, really interesting. If I may, again, and just the only small critique that I would have is I felt that the last issue, when Josiah's see, now I get confused by the grandson and the I guess it was Isaiah.
Isaiah's the original.
Yeah, when Isaiah's wife was telling Cap exactly what happened in the years after issue 6, wow, I really would have loved to have seen that represented in art as well as her narration.
Sure.
As opposed to getting Cap's reactions.
Sure.
And, I mean, Kyle did such an amazing job, and both Kyle and Robert. It's a great story. And
that's a fair critique. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I would have loved to have told more Black Captain America stories. And, you know, and then the baton's being passed a little bit. We see the Patriot and Young Avengers.
Yes.
Isaiah, there will be more to be said about Isaiah.
That's cool.
You know, the series sold really well. We got a lot of negativity before it launched. That was an interesting experience. But, you know, even guys like, there was a prominent guy who came out against it prior to publication, who wrote an editorial once it had come out, saying that he was wrong and he really enjoyed it.
That's cool.
So, you know, again, that's one I'm proud of, let's put it to you this way. There's books I'll be proud of even if no one else likes it, and there's books that I get patted on the back for that I know suck. And nobody can convince me they're good, you know.
Hey, if I add another book that cause a little controversy, The Rawhide Kid. I want to focus on the artist because, to me, John Severin is always left off the list of important Golden Age artists. And that guy is incredible to be in his 80s and still
be capable of
that level of work. Tell me what it was like working with him.
It's fantastic. I love working with John. John's a great old guy, and he's I've frequently asked him to adopt me, and he continues to refuse. He's just an old salt. You know, they broke the mold. He's a guy who just knows how to draw. I mean, I went to the conversation about Rawhide was John and I had been talking about doing a Western, and I said, John, I really want to work with you, but just Westerns, they just don't sell. Marvel isn't just, they're not going to pull the trigger, no pun intended, on a Western. And I was looking at all these Western characters, the Ghost Rider, and blah, blah. I looked at the Roy Kidd, and I thought, man, that guy is too good-looking to be straight. And so I called up John, and I said, John, look, you can hang up on me. But I said, you remember the Rawhide Kid, right? And he goes, remember the Rawhide Kid? I drew the Rawhide Kid first. Him and, I guess, Lieber was the first guy than him.
Wow.
He said, yeah, I remember the Rawhide Kid. And I said, well, John, he's gay. And there was like this pause, and then John just started to laugh. And he goes, you know, I think you're right. And we went on, and then after that, one of the fun things we would do was we would dig up old Rawhide Kids. And would find further evidence that he's gay.
Double entendres,
you know, covers, yeah, just covers. You know, I mean, the double entendres just—they're crazy. But I got to say, what was fascinating about Rawhide Kid to me was that the negativity that came our way from the hardcore fans. There was a prominent writer who was writing a core title of a DC book at the time, who went online and told his fan base, and this is a guy who had never had any negative experiences with me. Told everybody that I had lied to John.
I remember that.
And that John didn't know that the kid was gay. And that made me the most evil editor on the face of the planet.
Sure.
And John the dumbest artist.
Yes.
Joe Quesada had a lot to say about that, I remember. But it was interesting to me to just see how controversial it was and how it betrayed everything from, you know, conservatism to ridiculous levels of homophobia. By the same token, I was wondering about how the gay press would respond.
That was my next question.
You know, and I remember when I did my first interviews, you know, I remember, like, for The Advocate or something, they, speaking with the reporter, said to me, so, you know, how is it then that nobody involved in this project is gay? You know, how do you reconcile that? And I said, well, you know, the goal never was to put the reader into the heart and soul of a gay cowboy. It was to show the gay cowboy kicking ass. And they automatically got it and laughed, and then they reviewed it accordingly.
That's cool.
So it was cool because I was actually at an IKEA with my wife and kid a few years ago. And I saw this woman, and I recognized her, and then I realized that she'd been on PBS on a little half-hour special they had on Gays in Comics, which had focused on Rawhide Kid. And she was the head of GLAAD.
Okay.
Said, hey, I know you. You were on TV looking at Rawhide Kid. And she says, yeah, who are you? And I said, I edited that. And she looked at me and said, oh, man, I love that comic book. She said, half my friends said, man, that's so homophobic. And then the other half said, I know that guy. So you follow me? That,
absolutely.
For me, that's art.
You got both ends. That's terrific,
yeah.
That's why, Axel, I really think a lot of tried and true fans, they have built up expectations of how characters should be portrayed, period. And sometimes you just have to unclench your ass and appreciate a fun story.
But it's fascinating, too, because when if you engage in any type of debate with them, like, I'll give you an example. One day, the day after Roy Kidd broke in the New York Post, our phones are ringing off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a call at about 5:30, and I hear, please hold for Stan Lee. So I'm like, gulp. Next thing I know, there's Stan. He's like, kid, let me tell you, the Rawhide Kid was gay, always is, always was, always will be. And he says, I've read the first three issues of Rawhide Kid. It's fantastic. He says, I haven't read the last two. I'm going on Nightline tonight to debate this person. I don't know who they are, but I'm debating them. And I just need you to get me the scripts for the last two and walk me through what happens. So I walked him through it all, but my ears were still ringing because here I was, Stan Lee, Stan the man Lee had told me that the Rawhide Kid, who he'd created, was gay and always will be. And, you know, again, this was something where it's like, you know, we can communicate that to the fan base, but look, if Stan Lee says it's good enough for him, it's got to be good enough for anyone else. You know what I'm saying? If John Severin, who was one of the first two artists to draw the Rawhide Kid, is comfortable with this, then I'm comfortable with it.
I'm hip.
You know? Yeah, you get the gist.
That's awesome. That's very funny. Well, and of course, Stan had no problem with that. He had the one character in Sergeant Fury in the
exactly.
Howling Commandos that was gay.
So, my husband Corey was mentioning how he wrote a little bit about that in the intro. And now we've got the Rawhide Kid. I'm sure he'll touch upon that, too. You know? And again, if you don't want the Rawhide Kid to be gay, that's fine. He's not. That's part of the beauty of the Max imprint. is that it exists as its own thing.
Absolutely. You know? Well, that's good, man, and I'm glad to hear that there are more projects coming, because I think people got afraid. There were a lot of things that happened, and you were involved with some of them. I mean, Ecstatic, when Princess died.
Oh, yeah.
You guys had to, you know, turn her into somebody different.
Oh, yeah, there goes my job. Anyway.
And also the Fury. Were you in charge of the Garth Ennis Fury?
Yeah.
I love that book.
Yeah.
And I was so happy that you guys brought that Fury back to the Punisher, because...
Yeah.
I love that Fury. The hell with whatever problems came of it. I think it's a great way to show Nick Fury, and I'm a huge fan.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, again, there's going to be people, you know, I had a friend who is an editor who said to me how angry he was at Fury, you know, what had been done with Fury. And I said, just click your heels together and tell yourself it's only a dream. It's a Max book.
It's one
and
story.
It's a Max book. But also I said, look, you know, the one thing I just want you to understand is that it's like, look, for me, as being a hardcore Nick Fury fan from the old days when I would try and dig up the old Steranko books,
you bet.
The most disrespectful thing that's been done to Fury isn't one story where he wraps somebody up in their own intestines. It's the meaningless cameos he's had over decades where he don't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to cameo him, have him like that issue where he had the iron arm where he fought Captain America in his apartment back during Englehart and Sal Buscema, which I still got that comic book.
Sure.
Have it count, you know what I mean?
You bet.
And I think that that's the thing. You know, the Max imprint is a place where it operates outside of continuity. It's going for a different demographic. It's clearly labeled for adult readers. Either you want it or you don't. You know, the cage we did, same thing. You know,
Brian's Azzarello's cage.
Yeah, Brian and Richard Corbin's. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yes,
that's
of course,
another Max book. You know, the thing about the label is that there are times when you need additional latitude. You know, and there will be those who just don't like the fact that profanity or nudity or excessive violence will happen in a comic book, or that adult themes will be attached, and then don't buy it. But to dismiss, you know, the Max label, or for that matter, the Vertigo label, as being about tits and ass is ridiculous, you know?
That's cool. No, I appreciate that. And Shana is going to, when it comes out in hardcover, be back to the Max level of art?
Well, let's just say that we're talking about it right now.
Okay.
Yeah, let's just say we're talking about it right now, but I'm optimistic.
That's cool.
Yeah.
No, Axel, this has been great. I appreciate your time, and we've covered a lot of ground, and I would say continued success. I think you oversee a lot of the interesting books that I think, as an older reader myself, I appreciate the quirkier books, and it's nice to see that you're overseeing them and that they're coming out as well as they are. So continued success. And keep
going. Well, I hope that people out there keep an eye out for the Ghost Rider that's going to be debuting in July. Stick along with Moon Knight as it continues. And keep an eye out for Punisher War Journal when that debuts as well.
Is there anything you wanted to say about Ghost Rider and War Journal? We haven't really covered that.
Well, the War Journal is, of course, the book that will scratch the itch that Garth doesn't in Max. So if you have been yearning to see the Punisher on a mega human scale, then that'll be the place. Matt Fraction is the writer.
Big fan of Matt's. Loved Last
Great
of the
stuff.
Independents, for example.
Yeah,
great thing.
That's what he got the job based on.
Oh, and, there you go.
And Ari Lolivetti doing just incredible, incredible work. He's just operating at a whole different level these days. And Ghost Rider, I'm thrilled with that as well. Daniel Way, of course, and Mark Teixeira with Javier Solteras. You know, again, I've always been a fan of Ghost Rider. He is a product of the Evel Knievel era, let's put it that way.
Okay.
But, you know, again, if there's ever a character who was meant to be on the cover of Outlaw Biker magazine, it's the Ghost Rider.
No question.
And I think that the book's got the vibe to prove it.
And something like the Ghost Rider is what they're doing with the film. Does that come across your desk? Do you get any?
I've read the film. Yeah, I've
okay.
read the film, and I've seen raw footage from the film.
Does it influence the direction of what the book is going to be?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, the thing about the Ghost Rider comic book, the thing about the Ghost Rider character is he's pretty easy to understand.
Sure.
You know, a guy who made a Faustian bargain, and now he's paying for it.
Mm-hmm.
But what Daniel's doing with Ghost Rider, we're going back to the original Johnny Blaze, is we're taking a good hard look at his origin and how it all locks into place, the nature of this bargain he made with the devil, and just answering some questions that kind of hovered over the proceedings for a while, like, okay, if you're a spirit of vengeance and you owe something to Satan, then why is it when you're in the mortal plane you're always taking on bad guys? You follow me?
Sure.
Wouldn't it, if you were an agent of Satan and all this was going on, kind of stands to reason maybe you'd be looking to take out, I don't know, good guys?
Right, you'd be a bad guy too.
Exactly. So what's going on here, and how does this play out, and you know what exactly happened in that bargain? So I think that we've got some cool stuff here. I've got Ralph Macchio and Tom Brevoort as my sounding boards as we chart out our way. But again, I think what people will like about the Ghost Rider with this is that it'll be firmly situated in the Marvel Universe, and you'll get your first clues out of that soon. The first issue is the ultimate jailbreak, where he gets out of hell.
Okay.
Easier said than done. There's a price to be paid. And then from there, you've got a dirty biker movie with a, you know, a flaming skull guy with chains. So.
Nothing wrong with that. Are there any other genres that you haven't had a chance to explore yet with Marvel that you'd like to?
I've only dabbled a little bit in horror. I'd like to do a little bit more of that.
Okay.
I am beginning with Max to do that. I'd be interested in doing something. I'd be interested in doing a romance book, but I'd need an angle on it. And I mean a romance that doesn't involve Mary Jane. You follow me?
I do.
Spidey. But I'd like.
Sure.
I'd be interested in doing a romance book, even though I'd sooner slash my wrist than read a romance book.
Or an adult romance book, if you will, then?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of romance books.
Sure.
But again, I'm interested. When I was at Vertigo, I did an anthology called Heartthrobs, which was sordid love tales for boys, you know?
Okay.
So I'm intrigued by doing that. I think I'd like to do some more anthologies here, but those are very time-consuming and hard to...
Tough sells, too.
Yeah, they're tough sells. They're tough sells. So I'll probably put that off for another few years if I'm still here.
Well, I hope you get a chance to do it. And
yep.
Like I said, I appreciate the experimentation I see in a lot of the books you oversee. So
thank you.
Keep it up. And again, thank you for your time today.
Great. Thank you.
That's Marvel editor Axel Alonso. Be sure to check out books like The Wolverine Monthlies, Moon Knight, The Black Panther, Squadron Supreme, The Storm miniseries, and Amazing Spider-Man, all from Marvel Comics. That'll do it for this edition of WordBalloon.com. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to WordBalloon for updates on upcoming episodes. WordBalloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2006.